Now they were all there, 32 ships incongruously packed in a desolate harbor. Snow crowned the mountains that ringed the cold gray bay. Three lonely radio masts stood against the sky. Three small fishermen's huts and one bare concrete pier were the only other traces of civilization. Even so, Nagumo took no chances, no shore leaves, no rubbish overboard. When seaman Shigeki Yokota got the Kaga's garbage detail, he had to burn it right beside the pier. Commander Shimizu and the other supply ship skippers gradually transferred food, clothes, and thousands of drums of fuel oil to the task force. 5-gallon tins of oil were piled to the every empty space. When all was loaded, Shimizu told his crew to stay put until December 10th. Go fishing, do anything you want, but you can't leave the area. Then he transferred to the Akagi. He couldn't resist going along for the ride. Admiral Nagumo held a last conference on the Akagi on the night of the 23rd. Lieutenant Commander Suzuki told about his interesting trip to Honolulu. Commander Fuchida, who would lead the airstrike, scribbled away at his notes. The meeting ended with a toast of sake and three bonsais for the Emperor. On the 25th, Yamamoto ordered the fleet to get going the following day, and inevitably Admiral Nagumo spent a restless last night. At 2 a.m., he finally called in Lieutenant Commander Suzuki, apologized for waking him, and said he just had to check one point again. You're absolutely certain about not spotting the U.S. Pacific Fleet in Lahaina? Yes, Admiral. Nor is there any possibility it might assemble at Lahaina. Suzuki reassured him and went back to bed, deeply moved by the sight of the old admiral, all alone with his worries, pacing away the night in his kimono. At dawn, Suzuki left the Akagi and stood on the shore waving goodbye as the anchor chains rattled upward and the ships got underway. On the bridge of the Akagi, Admiral Kusaka tugged at his coat collar to escape the bitter wind that swept the cheerless morning. An unexpected hitch arose when a piece of cable snarled in the Akagi's propeller, but a diver got it free in half an hour, and by 8 a.m. the whole task force was clear of the harbor. As the Akagi glided by, a patrol boat's blinkers flashed through the gloom, "Good luck on your mission." Commander Gishiro Miura, the Akagi's navigation officer, certainly needed it. He had no easy job in weather like this, pounding seas, steady gales, and the thickest kind of fog. Miura was famous throughout the fleet for his sloppy, easygoing amiability, but it was all gone now. He stood stern and tense on the bridge. He wore a pair of shoes instead of his usual carpet slippers. Most of the time, the ships managed to keep in formation, the carriers in two parallel columns of three, the eight tankers trailing behind, the battleships and cruisers guarding the flanks, the destroyers screening the whole force, the subs scouting far ahead. But at night, the tankers, not used to this sort of work, would stray far and wide. Every morning, the destroyers herded them back to the fleet. The second day out, Admiral Nagumo and Kusaka clung to the plunging bridge of the Akagi, trying as usual to round up the tankers. Suddenly, Nagumo blurted, "Mr. Chief of Staff, what do you think? I feel that I've undertaken a heavy responsibility. If I had only been more firm and refused. Now we've left home waters and I'm beginning to wonder if the operation will work." Admiral Kusaka came up with the right answer. "Sir, there's no need to worry. We'll make out all right." Nagumo smiled. "I envy you, Mr. Kusaka. You're such an optimist." Admiral Nagumo must have felt even more discouraged when they first tried refueling on the 28th. This turned out to be dangerous, back-breaking work. As the ships bucked and plunged, the big hoses running from the tankers would snap loose and whiplash across the deck. Several crewmen were swept overboard, but nothing could be done about it. By the 30th, they were getting better at refueling, but now they had another problem. As the weather grew worse, oil drums stored on the deck of the light carrier Hiryu spilled, turning her into a skating rink. Commander Takahisa Amagai, the flight deck officer, wrapped straw rope around his boots to keep from falling, but barked his shins anyhow. On they plowed through nerve-racked days and sleepless nights. Admiral Kusaka catnapped in a canvas chair on the Akagi's bridge. Her chief engineer, Commander Yoshibumi Tanbo, did the same far below. He and his 350 men rarely left the engine room, lived in a life of oil and sweat beside their beloved machines. Mess attendants carried down all their meals, usually rice balls with pickled plums and radishes wrapped in bamboo bark. Everyone grew more and more restless. From the bridge of the Akagi, Admiral Kusaka watched the pilots endlessly check their planes, warm up the engines, run through daily calisthenics. On the Shokaku, Commander Hoichiro Tsukamoto never knew the time could pass so slowly. His mind was always wandering to his watch or clock. Captain Tadataka Endo, the ship's doctor, whiled away the hours playing shogi and go. Doctor, on the Hiryu, everyone speculated about the gauze mask that Group Leader Lieutenant Haita Matsumura wore over his mouth. He mumbled something about the unhealthy climate, and they marked him off as a hopeless hypochondriac. But they speculated most of all on where they were going. Fighter pilot Yoshioshiga on the Kaga was sure it would be in the north. All the planes had been changed to winter oil. Lieutenant J.G. Sukao Ibina, the Shokaku's junior medical officer, guessed Dutch Harbor. Shokaku's commander Tanbo down in the Akagi's engine room enjoyed a special advantage. He knew how far she could go on the fuel she carried. It all added up to the Philippines. Hardly anybody yet knew the truth. Last-ditch negotiations were being conducted by Japanese envoys in Washington, trying to win for Japan a free hand in Asia. If these talks unexpectedly succeeded, orders would be sent to Nagumo to turn around and come home. And if this were done, the world must never know what almost happened. So at this point, Nagumo couldn't risk telling anybody. But it was far more likely that the attack would come off, so the main job was to keep the fleet from being discovered. No waste could be thrown overboard. It might leave a telltale track. The ships used the highest-grade fuel to keep smoke at a minimum. The empty oil drums were carefully stowed away. Complete blackout and strict radio silence. On the Hiei, Commander Kazuyoshi Kochi, chief communications officer for the whole task force, disconnected an essential part of his transmitter, put it in a wooden box, and used it as a pillow whenever he managed to get in some sleep. They had several bad scares. Once Tokyo radioed that an unknown submarine had been detected. The fleet hastily changed course, only to discover that it was all a mistake. Another night, Admiral Kusaka suddenly spotted a light in the sky, thought it might be an unknown aircraft. It turned out to be a spark from the Kaga's funnel. She got a stiff warning to be more careful. One morning, the report spread that a Soviet ship was cruising nearby, en route from San Francisco to Russia. Every ship went on alert, but nothing came of it. Nor was there any way of checking such reports. Nagumo would not allow any planes in the air for fear of disclosing the fleet's presence. Arguments rambled over what to do if they were spotted by a neutral ship. At least one member of Nagumo's staff cheerfully advised, "Sink it and forget it." On December 2nd, this sort of bull session ended abruptly. The day before, the Imperial Council had decided on war, and now Admiral Yamamoto radioed the task force, "Climb Mount Niitaka." It was code for proceed with the attack. Another message later that day confirmed the date. X day will be 8 December, which was, of course, Sunday, December 7th in Hawaii. At last, the men were mustered and told. On the Kaga, seaman Shigeki Yokota, a 23-year-old farm boy, was frightened but philosophical. Down in the heat and noise of the Akagi's engine room, Commander Tanbo's men drank a quiet toast of sake. Somehow no one felt like more than one cup. But most of the crew howled banzais and shared seaman Iki Kuramoti's ecstasy. An air attack on Hawaii. A dream come true. Next morning, everyone seemed to take a new lease on life. The pilots were briefed on their specific assignments. The Army airfields at Hickam and Wheeler, Schofield Barracks, the naval air stations at Kaneohe and Ford Island, the Marine base at Ava, the U.S. fleet. On the Akagi, Admiral Kusaka produced a beautiful plaster of Paris relief map of Pearl Harbor. Previously, he had kept it under lock and key in his stateroom, accessible only to a few top officers. Now he had it installed on the hangar deck where everybody could use it. On the Kaga, the pilots played identification games. An air officer would hide silhouettes of the American ships behind his back. Then he would flash them one at a time for the flyers to name. Lieutenant Yoshioshiga just never could get the Utah. The flyers were now pampered by everybody, daily baths, special rations of fresh milk and eggs. Despite all the Shinto cult could do, these were promptly converted into American milkshakes. On the flagship, Admiral Nagumo worried more than ever about being discovered. He was indeed in a ticklish spot. If sighted by the enemy at any time before December 6th, he was to turn around and go home. If sighted on the 6th, he was to use his own judgment. Only on the 7th was he committed, no matter what happened. In the radio room of the Hiei, Commander Kochi listened intently to detect any sign that the Americans were onto the game. The intercepts were very reassuring. Soon a flow of messages began to arrive from home, so important that Kochi let his staff do the monitoring, and devoted his own attention entirely to Tokyo. Yamamoto was relaying the latest Honolulu intelligence on the U.S. fleet. On December 3rd, he radioed, November 28, 0800 local time, Pearl Harbor, two battleships, Oklahoma, Nevada, one aircraft carrier, Enterprise, two Class A cruisers, 12 destroyers, depart, five battleships, three Class A cruisers, three Class B cruisers, 12 destroyers, one seaplane carrier, enter. The following day, Nagumo refueled and crossed the international date line. This made no difference to the Japanese, who always kept their watches on Tokyo time, but to an American it explains why it is December 3rd again. By evening, the fleet was 900 miles north of Midway, 1,300 miles northwest of Oahu. Admiral Nagumo began veering southeast. On the Hiei, Commander Kochi caught another useful message relayed by Tokyo from Honolulu. November 29, p.m., local time, vessels anchored in Pearl Harbor, A-zone between Naval Arsenal and Ford Island,